Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
You don't think that it's time that somebody cared enough to have a dream?
Why are you getting so upset? This is not about you.
Yes, it is. You are a human affront to all women, and I am a woman.
At some point, you gotta decide for yourself who you are. Can't let nobody make that decision for you.
How do you go about getting an exorcism?
I beg your pardon?
Hi, this is Mark Kermode. Thanks for downloading this Kermode on Film podcast. Now, if you're a regular here, you'll know that every month I do a live show on stage at the BFI South Bank in London. But since lockdown, that show has moved online. If you want to check out the MK3D online shows, then just go to YouTube and search the BFI channel, or just go to YouTube and search MK3D. Now, each of those shows is an hour long, they're in a video format, and they're really good fun, so do check them out. But the shows tend to be rather guest-packed, and since we have an hour-long running restriction, we have to cut down the interviews. But here on Kermode on Film, we like to run longer versions of those interviews. Next month, you can hear me in conversation with the great Brian Cox and with director Salvador Simo, the man behind Buñuel in The Labyrinth of the Turtles. But in this episode, we'll hear from comedian Shazia Mirza about her guilty cinematic pleasures. But first up is the great Simon Pegg. So it's a great pleasure to welcome to the virtual online MK3D the great Simon Pegg. Simon, where are you? You look like you're in space.
I wish. No, I'm at my house in my little place where I go to see movies. I thought that was an appropriate venue to chat to you from.
So have you? You've got a movie viewing room in your house?
I have. Yeah. I figured it was going to be necessary for work. So put it through the business,
yeah.
Obs. And it's our sort of our little screening room where we go. It's where I show my daughter all of the films that she should be watching.
That's fantastic. And what have you got? Have you got like a proper pull down screen? Have you got large?
Yeah, it's got curtains, and it all is automated, and you press a button, and it goes dark.
Oh, wow.
And the curtains open. It's all the bells and whistles. It's based on the ABC. Cinema in Gloucester, where I grew up, where I saw all my formative sort of films. So it's all sort of red and black, and yeah.
When the Phoenix in East Finchley was doing a refurb, they offered to sell me some of the chairs because I had spent my entire childhood in the Phoenix, and it was simply a transportation thing. I couldn't, and it breaks my heart because I could have actually had the chair on the end row on the left-hand aisle that I always used to sit on. It was uncomfortable as all hell.
Yeah, but
I would love to have had it.
What a thing. Yeah, absolutely.
Are you missing being in cinemas? Because obviously lockdown is now 3 months. Are you missing that communal experience?
Yeah, I think that's the key thing that people tend to overlook when they talk about the importance of theatrical cinema. It's not about seeing it on a big screen. That big screen is just there to accommodate the fact that you're going to watch it with a whole group of people you don't know. And that's a sort of a really important function of cinema as a viewing experience. It's like watching something with a whole bunch of people you don't know and sharing it, and I miss that for sure, because it's at its best in a full theater when everyone's into it, it's just the best.
Do you know when you go back to filming in September, will it be socially distanced filming, or will it be filming as before?
Well, it's all exterior stuff. It's all the sort of location. This is for Mission Impossible, so I guess there'll be sort of procedures, but I'm not sure exactly what that is. I read somewhere that Tom Cruise is building a huge COVID village. I don't know if that's true. I don't think it is.
So will you have to go into isolation when you do your stuff? Because we've heard a lot of stuff about movies being shot by like the entire crew going to isolate for 3 months. I was talking to Guillermo del Toro not so long ago, and he was talking about a similar thing, about everyone moving in together for the duration.
Well, it might be the case. You know, we start off, it's all overseas location. We start in Norway. And so I guess it depends on what their kind of guidelines are and stuff. But it makes sense that we should all kind of remain together. So maybe Tom's village is true.
There are worse places that you could be isolated than Tom Cruise's super village in Norway. I mean, I think that sounds like a fantastic package holiday.
It does,
frankly.
Doesn't it? Yeah.
And what, during lockdown, have you managed to catch up with any sort of classic movies that you've been wanting to watch but didn't have the time to do?
Yeah, well, my daughter's 10, so she's sort of at that age now when she can... I've always shown her movies that I felt like she might not see if she didn't have a film fan as a dad, so... as a youngster, you know, all the Amblin movies and the sort of set text of my childhood. And now she's a little older. We've been watching films like, she watched Aliens the other night. We had a little monster rally. We watched A Quiet Place, Monsters, Gareth Edwards Monsters, Cloverfield, and then Aliens. Because she's pretty cool with that stuff. She's grown up around film, so she knows that she doesn't get too freaked out by it. But... yeah, watching Aliens again was, I mean, I've seen it a lot of times, but it's such a great movie. And I think what's really impressive about it is that it was made, I think it cost $19 million in 86, whenever it was made. And even adjusted for inflation, that's about $39 now. So that's a really big, exciting, smart kind of blockbuster made for less than $50 million. You just wouldn't get that these days, you know.
Which version did you show her? Did you show her the extended version with all the backstory about Ripley losing the daughter, or did you go for the version that opened in cinemas?
Just the theatrical. And she hasn't seen Alien yet, because that's a little bit, I think that's a little bit more psychologically disturbing. It's a slasher film, isn't it? So I think I'm saving that one. So I did have to, it was a little bit, it galled me a little bit to go straight to Aliens, but we did Terminator and Terminator 2 last weekend. And what was great about that was that she was fully there for the twist of Terminator 2, because she knew nothing about it. So she assumed that the Terminator was the bad guy and the handsome sort of skinny guy was going to be the goodie. So she went through that, and it was so great to vicariously share that with her.
I think one of the best experiences is showing films you love to your kids. I watched Exorcist with my son, who's, you know, he's now old enough.
Yeah.
And I was terrified, because I was terrified that he wouldn't like it or wouldn't get it or something.
Yeah.
And so we watched it. I said, you have to do the whole thing from beginning to end. No, you know, no messing around all the way through. And then we watched it. And at the end of it, he went, well, it's brilliant. And I thought, that's it. We can stay, father and son, because otherwise we wouldn't have had
it. It's nerve-wracking, isn't it? Because you feel a certain responsibility for the film and your own taste. And so when you do throw them a curveball that's a little less kind of mass entertainment and a bit more thoughtful, you kind of want them to get it. And and it's such a relief when they like it, because you think, oh, thank goodness, I'm validated.
Yeah. And there's a couple of films that I'm terrified of, but there's a 70s movie called Jeremy. There's a love story that I love that everyone else hates, as far as I can tell. And I'm terrified. They keep saying, come on, Dad, show us Jeremy. And I don't want to, because I don't think I could face the disappointment of them going, it's all right, it's not very good.
Yeah,
and
it
kind of really breaks my heart. As far as Aliens is concerned as well, I made a doc about Aliens, and I interviewed Carrie Henn, you know, Newt. Who's, you know, grew up. She didn't want to act afterwards. She did it. She loved it. That was it. And then she went on. Yeah, she got you know, got a proper job. I said, do people come up to you still and say they mostly come at night?
Mostly.
And she said, yeah. The word mostly is the word that I hear more than any other word.
That's brilliant. I remember I had a big conversation on the set of Mission Impossible: Ghost Protocol. And it was with Chris McQuarrie, who'd come in to do some rewrites. And they had been talking about killing off Ethan's wife, Julia, who appears subsequently in some of the other movies. And he changed that. And I remember having this discussion about that with him, because I thought that was a better idea. Because I will never show Tilly Alien 3 unless she asks to see it. Because killing Newt and Hicks completely retroactively ruins Aliens, because all she goes through for them, and then suddenly they're just arbitrarily, and it might have felt like, I know Fincher was probably being sort of like, I'll wipe the slate clean kind of thing, but it just, as far as sequels spoiling their predecessors, that one, that's a crime, that killing those two characters after everything Ripley did.
Sigourney Weaver told me that she went to see the Alien 3 preview with Carrie Henn, and that in that one moment when you see Newt dead,
yeah,
it's not her obviously, but she put her hand over Carrie Henn's eyes to sort of protect her, which I thought was really lovely. And it's so brutal because, as you say, we've got the family unit back together again at the end. It's lovely, and they're dead by the time the opening credits start.
Exactly.
So you've got a couple of films coming our way, which I haven't seen, or I've seen the trailers for. Tell us first about Inheritance, because creepy, scary trailer.
Yeah, Inheritance is a thriller. I really like this screenplay because it was very talky, and it felt a little bit, the scenes between my character and Lily Collins' character, Lauren, were felt quite theatrical. And you don't get the chance to do that much in cinema, particularly the stuff I've been doing of late, which is always, you know, shot very incrementally. And I'm, you know, I'll say, go left, go right, and then scene ends. But this is sort of chewy, almost a two-hander, about a girl who inherits this terrible secret from her father, this guy who's been held captive on their property. And it was a really fun shoot. We made it in Alabama, of all places. And it took about 12 days to shoot my stuff. We shot in a bunker set, which was in a paper factory in Birmingham, Alabama. And it was a hoot. It's quite sort of schlocky and it's fun. It's a fun movie.
Attack. I mean, how'd that even happen? Dad was in better shape than either of us.
Lauren, there's something I need to discuss with you.
What is it?
Your father left this for you. And you alone.
Does any daughter really know her father?
And you've also worked fantastically with Juno Temple, of whom I am a huge fan, although this says something about our respective ages, that I'm friends with Juno Temple's dad.
Oh, yeah, of course.
So, but I think she's a fantastic actress. Tell us about that project.
Yeah, that's Lost Transmissions, which was a film I shot in Los Angeles in 2018. And it had its premiere at the Tribeca Film Festival in 2019. So, you know, to get it, obviously with indie films, they take a lot longer to emerge because they have to get distribution and what have you. So it's finally getting its release now here in the UK. And it was a film I was really, really happy to do. It was a script that came my way that I was surprised to get it. It's a drama about a schizophrenic music producer who sort of comes off his meds and gets lost in LA, and Juno's character Hannah sort of tries to save him. But I don't often get sent scripts like that because I'm known for doing comedy. And I was thrilled that Catherine O'Brien, who was the writer, director, she sent it to me. And it also dawned on me that I'd never made a feature film directed by a woman in however long I've been making them. And that felt remiss, even though it's not my fault, other than my being part of the patriarchy. And I thought, I need to do this, you know. And it was an amazing experience. I went from shooting Mission Fallout, which was, I think, 108 days, to Lost Transmissions, which was about a 20-day shoot, all shot handheld on location in Los Angeles. We had one dolly shot in the whole shoot. The DP was lighting it with these sort of like LED strips and stuff. It was all very guerrilla style, but it was a fantastic experience and a chance to just flex some different muscles, you know.
And who did you look to anyone as a model for your role? Because I was looking at thinking, you know, well, I always think of Joe Meek, who I think is the kind of, you know, the great troubled music producer. But was there anybody that was particularly in your mind when you were doing it?
Well, it's based on a real person who I met and spoke to, and a friend of Catherine's, and she wrote the screenplay based on this experience that she had had with this person. And so I was able to kind of meet the person who the film was based on. And I also went and met schizophrenics and did as much research as possible. I didn't want to wing it. Do you know what I mean? I think it's quite easy to play crazy and schizophrenia is a very specific condition. So I wanted to walk into the shoot knowing exactly what I was supposed to be portraying. So, I did a lot of research in that regard.
And how did you find it, Simon? Was it rewarding?
Oh, I loved it. Yeah, I really, really loved it. Because it, you know, when you're making a film like that, you work from the beginning of the day to the end of the day. You're never back in your trailer waiting for setups and stuff. You're running the whole time. It was a real chance to do something different and to learn a new sort of process. And working with Juno was great. Juno's really, really fun. And we hit it off straight away in terms of our sort of chemistry, which was really, really helpful because the two characters, it's not like a romance between them, it's a friendship. And in that, it really sort of mirrored mine and Juno's relationship in that respect. So it was, yeah, I really, really enjoyed it. I'd like to do more.
I just don't see you as just being like a cog in a big machine.
Darren, I love her. I love her. I want her. Can I have her?
You know, when a singer finds a writer they think sounds like them, they hang on for life.
Come on, I want my next hit.
Look here, listen really carefully. You can hear that transmission. I scare people.
Don't scare me. That sounds so good.
That's nice. I like that.
We've constructed like a whole made-up world, and it stops us from seeing everything how it really is.
Stop thinking.
What are you feeling?
If you can put that into your work, then you're going to come up with something really great.
We asked you to think of two things. I don't know whether you managed to do this, which was a guilty pleasure movie and a movie that you kind of turn to that inspires you. Did you have a chance to think about
that? Yeah, absolutely.
These?
I think my guilty pleasure isn't Howard the Duck, which is yours.
I love Howard the Duck. I won't hear a word about Howard the Duck, okay? And people get this whole thing. They go, what is it with you and Howard the Duck? You go, it's Howard the Duck. They go, it's a bloke in a duck suit. You go, yeah, it's Howard the Duck.
I slightly blanch at guilty pleasure because it kind of it does imply that you're ashamed of that, like, which I'm not, and neither of you of Howard. But those old sort of Italian sub-Romero horrors made by Lucio Fulci in the sort of late 70s, films like Let Sleeping Corpses, which I think was called Living Dead at the Manchester Morgue here, and Zombie 2 and The Beyond. They're really badly put together, shot in Italian, dubbed badly into English. Really quite sort of, you know, terrible pacing, but there's something about them which I just quite love. I love their sort of amateurish, the glee, the horrific kind of gore, which looks very, you know, dated now. I do love those films.
Look, it's not my fault, Sergeant, if Christ and saints are out of fashion. Satan's all the rage these days.
Listen, boy, you keep getting on my nerves, and I'm going to give you another kind of house to look after. One with lots of bars in the windows.
Better reinforce that door. Take the lamp.
I can just imagine the sergeant's face when he finds out.
Craig, can you hear me?
Sergeant, they're dead people trying to kill me.
Message for you.
Look, I know it sounds silly, but is it possible? I mean, could a film fail to catch an image for any reason?
Well, a ghost, maybe.
Were you a video nasties watcher when you... Because you're younger than me, I think.
I'm 50, I just...
Okay, so you are younger than me. Were you in the right... Were you old enough to be somebody who went and got video nasties from the video store? Were you too young for that?
It was probably a couple of years older than me. The 16 and when that happened, when that whole thing happened, I remember it happening. I remember hearing about Dawn of the Dead, for instance, and Evil Dead. These great movies, you know, that were lumped in with these lesser sort of efforts. But my first videos that I rented were things like American Werewolf and The Howling and The Thing. You know, they were and they're not so much video nasties; they're classics. But no, I didn't see Driller Killer or Death Trap or any of those those real you know classics of the genre.
I just remember that was how I, you know, discovered Fulci, was because they would always have the most garish covers and the most garish titles, and and you know, you knew that 10 minutes into them somebody was going to vomit up their entire intestinal yeah. system, you know, and it was just a promise. And I remember just thinking, that's what horror films ought to look like, the kind of thing that makes you almost want to run yeah. out of the room. Because you,
I remember reading about that very scene in my Encyclopedia of Horror, which I had as a kid, and it had pictures of some of these films in, and they were this rare kind of terrifying prospect of these films where somebody would like have their eye impaled on a splinter or throw up their guts like that, you know. And I was reading about it just thinking, and I remember the description of Dawn of the Dead was a shopping mall which becomes awash with blood. And that, just that sentence made me think, I've got to see this movie.
But the difference is that with the Romeros and with Dawn of the Dead, you know, there is an awful lot of thematic substance. With the Fulcis, with the zombie flesh eaters, it is a matter of, I want to see the spike of wood stick through somebody's yeah, yeah. eye. And then they've released cut versions when the spike didn't. And you go, no,
I've
been here for an hour. That's right, I've been here for a whole yeah. hour. I need to see the spike going into
it's
somebody's
so true.
Eye.
And it feels to me like it's a kind of misunderstanding of what made Romero's work great. It's like somebody saw it and thought, oh, okay, it's about this. And it's not about that. It's about, Romero's work is far more sort of, you know, nutritious, I think, intellectually. But Fulci was just like, no, it's all about guts and eyeballs, and which is fine.
Yeah, I mean, I think when you look at Shaun of the Dead, it's Romero.
Totally, yeah.
And that's, you know, and because it has thematic substance and it has pathos and friendship and meaning yeah. and, you know, I don't think I can kill my dad and my best friend, and you know, all yeah. that stuff. Whereas Fulci would just be, yeah, pass me the axe. <That's fine."
laughs> No emotional repercussions whatsoever.
Okay, that's a great choice. What about the movie that inspires you, the movie that you go back to?
I think rather than sort of choose one that I saw as a child, which I think, you know, the obvious ones which would have informed me as a youngster, I'd say Raising Arizona, the Coen brothers, which I saw as a student, and it really kind of educated me in terms of how a comedy film can be so much more than just the script. It can be the way that the camera moves. It can be, I think, for me and Edgar, actually, our sort of understanding of foreshadowing and paying off and you know, having reflections in the dialogue and in the imagery. It's a real masterclass in comedy filmmaking. And I think, for me, just one of the best films ever. It's up there in my top five for sure. Just, and that's because of Nicolas Cage and Holly Hunter's performances, which are just unbelievably pitched, you know, beyond any kind of restraint, but it works so well. All of them, you know, Frances McDormand, everybody in that film is just on a very heightened level, which is hilarious. But also the Coens having that little, I think they were having a little kind of shot off with Raimi at the time of who can, there's that shot in Evil Dead when there's a shot in Raising Arizona where the camera goes up over the car and then into the window into Mrs. Arizona's mouth. And then in Evil Dead 2, Sam Raimi made the camera go through the back window of the car as a kind of like, right, I'm going to go one better. But yeah, all that sort of exuberance. It's just a brilliant film, I think.
Where's that baby? Where's he at?
You'll find him, honey.
Cut it out, Glenn.
He's asleep right now.
Shit, I hope we didn't wake you.
Can I just sneak a peekaloo?
Come on, kids. Get away from Mr. McDonough's car.
What's his name? Hi, Junior, till we think of a better one. Well, why don't you call him Jason? I just love biblical names. If I had another little boy, I would name him Jason, Caleb, or Tab. Oh, he's an angel. He's an angel straight from heaven. No, honey. I had all my kids the hard way. You just got to tell me how you got this little angel. What do you do? Just fly straight down from heaven. Well, you're going to send them to Arizona State.
I love the fact that that Raimi and the Coens come out of the same creative swamp, that they were very much kind of a piece. And, you know, Raimi, when he made Evil Dead was banned under the Obscene Publications Act here. And people, you know, it was one of the BBFC examiners when they first saw it. They said that they felt that they had been physically assaulted by the film. And then And then Raimi then went on to direct some of the biggest franchise successes of all time. And then the Coens, meanwhile, go on to be the most celebrated, you know, duo filmmakers of all. So it's kind of like we were right.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, we were all right. We were there first.
Totally. And that's like saying being physically assaulted by a film is a bad thing. If you come out of a film that moved, then surely that's really worthwhile, you know, and rather than coming out of a film and going, yeah, that was okay, you know.
So is Raising Arizona your Coen's favourite, or are you just a lover of all the Coens?
I do love the Coens. I would say Raising Arizona probably is, just because of the affection I have for it. But, you know, I mean, you get into things like Lebowski and, you know, Blood Simple that have a joy to them for different reasons. They're just brilliant. They're consistent. They do have little dips now and again. I enjoyed the Netflix, the cowboy one, Buster Scruggs.
Oh yeah. With Tom Waits as the prospector.
Yeah, the indestructible.
And you go, what?
Yeah.
Literally, it's like,
you can only understand him when he sings.
Yeah, no, I think that film's it's a really sharp film. You say they have their ups and downs, but the thing is, you think, don't worry, there'll be another one along in a moment. Plus, the ones that you don't like the first time round, quite often I've been told to go back and watch. You know, I didn't like Big Lebowski the first time round. I was one of the people who thought, no, but you know. I do accept now that it is a classic in its, you know, in its own way. I can say my favourite is still Blood Simple, just because I remember seeing it on a double bill with The Evil Dead and just going, oh my God, this is what the future of cinema looks like. It's raw and brilliant, and you know,
it is an incredible sort of back catalogue that they have. It just, they're constantly changing their focus and their approach. It's not like they've set on one thing, which they do. They've never made another Looney Tunes comedy like Raising Arizona, and yet it was the pinnacle of that kind of filmmaking. You know, they could have made a bunch more of those films in that vein, but they just keep mutating and trying new things. And yes, sometimes some are more successful than others, but you've got to hand it to them for that kind of innovation.
Yeah. Simon, we've kept you for a half an hour. Thank you ever so much. I could shoot the breeze with you about movies for the rest of the day, but I know you have better things to do with your time. Thank you so much. I'm really looking forward to the Mission Impossibles, which I love. I've had such good fun in the cinema with the Mission Impossibles.
Yeah.
Inheritance looks terrific. The first two times that you're in the trailer, I didn't recognise that it was you, which is great.
Yes.
That's what you want to say. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And I'm really, really looking forward to Lost Transmissions as well. I know it's been delayed for a little bit, but I'm really looking forward to that. Excellent. And I hope we all get to be back in cinemas at some point in the near future. Best of luck to you. Thank you ever so much for sparing the time to come and speak to
us. Thanks, Mark. My pleasure.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
My thanks to Simon Pegg, and as I said, if you want to watch a cut-down video version of that interview, then go to the BFI channel on YouTube. Put in MK3D or BFI channel, you'll find it easy enough. My next guest is Shazia Mirza, a comedian and film fan who we asked to choose her guilty pleasures. She came up with some quite extraordinary choices, but I began by asking her about her own life and work. So, welcome to, I think this is now the third online MK3D. Obviously, we usually do these live at the BFI South Bank, but under current circumstances, everything is done from home. How have you been handling lockdown? What have you managed to do? Because obviously you were about, you were just at the beginning of a tour when all this started. Yeah. So how's it been?
Well, I did two tour dates and then the whole tour got cancelled. I was meant to be doing Soho Theatre all this week and obviously it's not happening.
Oh.
But I've just been sitting at home getting fat, grey and hairy, really, like everybody else. What else is there to do? Really, it's limited. But I finished writing my stand-up show, finished writing my book, and I recorded a little film for the BBC last week about how to get humour in a pandemic. That took me all week, obviously, because I was filming it myself. So little things take a lot of time.
How are you dealing with the technology? One of the things that I've found is that everything that I would do that would normally take 15 minutes takes 4 hours because I, like, even just before we started, I'm going, I'm pressing this and I'm pressing that and I'm doing that. Yeah. Are you similar?
It's all right for people who are 16 or 17 years old, but anybody above 20, I mean, it took me 9 hours to upload just a picture onto Instagram. It just wouldn't upload. And then I asked this 20-year-old kid to do it and he did it in 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And we don't do this normally in real life.
It's a really terrifying thing. I have children. They're grown now. One of them's a teenager. One of them's just out of teenagers. But I still, like, if I need to upgrade my phone or something, I just have to give it to them and say, can you do it? Because it's like I haven't been given the keys to the magical kingdom of the internet. Yeah. I don't fully understand how it works. And to be honest with you, I'm never going to.
You don't care.
I just don't want my kids to leave home. Because if they do, I won't be able to work the remote control.
I think we're too far gone. Anyone over 25 is too far gone to be wasting their life in this kind of thing.
Now, where are you? You have a fantastic backdrop. Where are you at the moment? Where do we find you?
Well, I'm at my parents' house in Birmingham. Everybody in Birmingham has this wallpaper. It is the law. If any house in Birmingham has black wallpaper with red flowers, only at your parents' house, nowhere else.
Is there a particular name for that design? It's very striking.
Yes, it's called Out of Date. That's what it's called.
Now, whereabouts in Birmingham are you? I lived very, very briefly in King's Heath.
That's nice.
Yeah, it was very nice. Lots of parks and everything. But I ended up living there by mistake. But it was very nice. And I always had this very romantic idea about Birmingham because we used to drive through Birmingham on the way to Liverpool to go to the Isle of Man. And I used to look out and see the Rotunda and think, that looks like the biggest city I've ever seen. So which part of Birmingham are you in?
Edgbaston. My parents live in Edgbaston, round the corner from the cricket ground. And it's really nice. They've got loads of parks. It's very green. It's quiet. There's not many people around. I mean, it's very nice. It's very quiet. I just don't want to live here. I live in London.
So did you just happen to be there when this all happened, or did you went?
No, look, I didn't do a Cummings. I just didn't do that. My eyes are fine. I didn't have to do an eye test. What I did was I just came last week, actually, just last week, because I was in London and I just needed to go somewhere. So I came here for a bit.
Yeah.
Because my tour's cancelled. There's nothing going on. So I thought I'd come and see my parents before they die.
Now, this show is nominally a film show, and we asked you to think about some of the movies that were important to you. And can you tell me about the first time you went to the cinema?
The first time that I remember going to the cinema, I was about 7 or 8 years old, and my dad took me and my brothers to watch Jungle Book. Because that was the biggest movie at the time. All the kids at school were watching Jungle Book. I wanted to watch it. I'd had read books about it. I'd seen loads of cartoons on TV, and I just thought, I've got to watch Jungle Book. Everybody's watching Jungle Book. And that was the film for kids to watch at that time.
Did you love it?
Oh my God, I loved it. I loved all the characters in it. Mowgli. I had a picture of Mowgli by my bed after I'd watched it in the cinema. I really thought that Mowgli was real, and one day I would meet the baby, and we would be friends. I really also, to me, I know it's like an animation, but the snake, the panther, The bear, they were real to me. They were people to me. As a kid, I know that it's an animation, but they were real people, characters.
Did you go and see the, in inverted commas, live action version that came out a few years ago, in which it was a real boy, although everything else was CG? Did you go and do that, or did you just keep the memory precious?
No, I will always think of Jungle Book as that animation that I saw as a kid. And I don't think it will ever be as good, because when you're a kid and you go to the cinema for the first time, you're transported to a different world. And that is that was my reality. That's how I'll always see it. And I don't want it to be ruined in a way, because I loved it so much.
Now, did you get much cinema going in, or were you somebody who was much more a homebody?
Well, when I was a kid, we didn't go to the cinema that much. It was considered to be a really adventurous and kind of extravagant thing to do, go to the cinema. It was something we did like maybe once a year. It was that much of an event.
Wow.
Whereas when I grew up, I went to university, I was watching, you know, I used to watch films. I used to go to the cinema 3-4 times a week.
Yeah.
When I was, and even now in this lockdown, I've been watching at least one film a day. Sometimes two films a day.
Now, what have you seen that's really struck you during that? Because that's a great way to spend lockdown. So what's hit home for you?
I wanted to watch films that I hadn't watched for a long time, or things that I should have watched and I didn't watch.
Yeah.
When they were out in the cinema. So I watched things like Taxi Driver, De Niro. I watched that the other night. And I think I did watch that as a kid, like maybe 10 years ago. But I watched it again. City of Angels, Notebook, about Schmidt, Frankie and Johnny, Scent of a Woman.
Wow.
As Good as It Gets. I love Jack Nicholson. I watched Barefoot in the Park. I found it difficult to watch. I kept falling asleep during it. And I thought, no, I must finish watching this film. So I'd get up the next day and make sure I finished watching it. Casino. Something's Got to Give, Evelyn, Pursuit of Happiness. These are all films I've watched in lockdown.
That's an extraordinarily wide range. What's guiding the path? Is it just you just thinking, I haven't seen that before, I need to catch up with that? Is there a theme through those? I mean,
no. Sometimes my friends on Instagram they'll say, oh, you should watch this. Or a lot of times I do go on other people's recommendations when they go, oh, this is a good film, you should watch this. And I think, oh, I haven't watched that, I'll watch it now. So a lot of times they are stuff that I see people online writing about on Instagram or Facebook, I've watched this or you should watch this. And then I do go on recommendations like that.
Okay. Now, we asked you to choose a couple of movies that we refer to here as guilty pleasures, although I do understand that there's no such thing as a guilty pleasure. There's just a pleasure or not. And you went for a couple of very surprising choices. So tell me what the first of your choices was.
The first one is Bitter Moon by Roman Polanski. It's a 1992 film. And I don't tell many people this, but I can't stop watching it. I've watched it maybe about 50 times. I watch it at least once a year. I find it absolutely fascinating and awful. It's an awful film. The women in it are portrayed horrifically, badly, needy, desperate, pathetic characters. And I can't bear to watch it, but I can't stop watching it.
So why do you, I know this, why do you keep going back to it?
I think it's fascinating. I think Roman Polanski's portrayal of women in this film is really fascinating. It says a lot about, I think, how he views women, or he thinks that this is how women are or should be. And in this film, it's awful how Mimi, the main character, is treated by Oscar, her husband. She's treated awfully. And there are many scenes in this which are, I find, disturbing but entertaining at the same time.
Okay, explain that for me. Disturbing and entertaining at the same time. Tell me what you mean.
It is. I think it is. I mean, at the beginning of the film, this guy, Oscar, he is, you know, he's coming up to his 40s. He wants to be a writer. He's a failed writer. He can't get any books published. He's clearly unhappy in his life. You know, he meets, he sees this girl, Mimi, on a bus. She's young. She's beautiful. You know, he's sexually attracted to her. And, you know, at the beginning of the film, there's a scene where they're having breakfast and they have an argument and she throws milk at him, a carton of milk at him. And he grabs her by the hair and slaps her across the face three or four times and she lands on the floor. And it's not like pretending to hit her. You see him grabbing her by the hair and slapping her. And you see his violence and hatred towards her. And this continues throughout the film. There's many scenes where, you know, he abuses her badly. There's a scene where he's in hospital, he's broken his leg, and she comes in and she takes his leg off, the strap that it's on, so he becomes a paraplegic. So she has to look after him. He has to love her. She has to love him. There comes a time, there's a scene where he takes her on holiday, decides to take her to the Caribbean, and he gets her on a plane, and they're about to take off, and he gets off the plane and leaves her to go on holiday by herself. There's another scene where he takes her to a party, and he flirts with other women and humiliates her, laughs at her, laughs at her haircut, laughs at the way she looks, totally just takes the piss out of her. There's another scene where she cooks him a chicken for dinner. And he says, oh, this is rubbish. It's burnt. It's awful. I'm going out. I'm going to go and eat out.
And I'll come back to the same question. I mean, I said at the beginning of this, there's no such thing as a guilty pleasure, but I think actually you've changed my my definition of that. What are you getting out of watching it over and over again? Because when you're describing it, it just sounds like a catalogue of woe. I confess, I haven't seen Bitter Moon since it came out, and nothing has ever made me think, I really want to go back and watch it again.
You know, I think a lot of people would say, especially now these days, you know, since the Me Too and, you know, the kind of progression of modern feminism, a lot of women and a lot of men would say, we don't need to see this kind of thing, or this is not nice to watch, or this is misogynistic and this is anti-women. And it's all of those things, which is why I think we should see it. Roman Polanski's depiction of women is horrible, but I think his misogyny is the greatest part of him. It's the greatest part of all his films. The way he views women, it's dark and it's kind of rock bottom. It's nasty, it's mocking, it's dark. But there are men that view women like that. There are men that treat women like that. And I would rather see it than not see it. I would rather watch a film where a man is punching a woman in the face rather than a scene which alludes to a woman being beaten or a woman walks out the bedroom with bruises on her face. No, I want to see what that man does to that woman because that will affect me. And I want a film to affect me.
Remember the carousel?
Sure, I remember the carousel. I remember it like a trip to the dentist. Easy. Easy. Ah!
Ah! Ah! Asshole. Did you think I'd forgotten?
She came to see me when I got out of intensive care. She said there's bad news and there's good news. You're paralyzed from the waist down, permanently. Okay, I said, let's have the good news. That was the good news, she said. The bad news is that from now on, I'm taking care of you.
Now, your other choice is equally upbeat and lighthearted. What was your second choice?
It's a Raging Bull.
A laugh riot.
But it's you know, Raging Bull. This is also 1980. This is black and white. It's that old, 40 years old. And I watched it the other night, and I remember it. I remember it well. But, you know, De Niro, Pesci, Scorsese, it's magic. The three people together. It's always fireworks, and it's the violence in this film is also the greatest part of this film. But it inspires me in my comedy. This is not a funny film. Neither of these are funny films. But this film inspires me in my comedy because Scorsese takes things to the edge. He takes things right to the edge here, whether you like it or not. This is what he wants to show. This is what he wants to say. This is how he wants to portray his characters. And he doesn't hold back here. Right, and it's relentless. There's no redeemable characteristics about Jake LaMotta, the main character in this, De Niro. There is nothing likable about him. There is nothing nice about him. And it's relentless from the beginning. In one of the first scenes in the film, you see him grabbing the back of the neck of his first wife and pushing her into a room over a fight about a piece of steak. You know this is going to be unreasonable right from the beginning. And this carries on throughout the film. He punches his second wife in the face repeatedly. We see this a lot of times. And there's something really sad about this man. Something really tragic about this main character that I just couldn't stop watching.
There's a famous story that when De Niro was trying to get the project off the ground and try to get Scorsese to direct it, that they had taken it to, they'd taken this version of the script to a producer, and the producer said, "Why would you want to make this film? It's about a cockroach." And De Niro had to say, "No, it's not about that." But it was the reaction of the producer when they first read it is, "Why would I want to watch a film about this person?" So what is it about the film that that transcends that? I mean, you've talked about, you know, the violence and the honesty of it. What is it about that the film that transcends that?
I don't think this film is mindless violence. I think it's very complex brutality in this film. This is a very complex person. And I think you could say, you know, he's a boxer. He's an Italian-American boxer. You could view the film and think, oh, well, you know, well, Italian-Americans, that's how they treat their women, the same as an Irish family, an Asian family. But it's not about that. I think it's about the person that he is, you know, sexually insecure, paranoid. I'm totally unconfident about his body, his weight, and very complex, because as a comedian I'm watching this and there is nothing likable about this man at all. It's a very sad character. And then later on in the film, towards the end, he tries to be a stand-up comedian. And after all you've seen this man do, he tries to be a stand-up comedian. And I was watching it thinking, a man that is this dark can never be this funny. He can never be that funny. Someone that is that awful can never be a comedian. I mean, comedians are many things, you know. They can be alcoholics, drug addicts, narcissists, liars. But inherently, they are not bad people because they are in the business of making people laugh. And if you're in the business of making people laugh, you're trying to make people happy. And this is a man who beat both of his wives, punched them in the face, you know, abused his brother and his coach, slept with an underage girl. He's an awful person.
So
when he tries to get on stage and be a comedian, I thought, no.
So where do you stand on King of Comedy, in which the whole film is basically Robert De Niro as, you know, as the wannabe stand-up comic who wants it so much that he ends up kidnapping his hero? I mean, I've always thought that film was a kind of a terrifying companion piece to Taxi Driver, because he just reminds me of Travis Bickle.
But I felt that that was funny. It made me laugh in many ways. There was nothing about Raging Bull that made me laugh.
No.
And some of Scorsese's films, especially when you've got the music going, he's always got, especially in this film, in Raging Bull, he's got some beautiful music. The theme tune to this is really beautiful. And that coupled with the violence, it made this film sad. There are some films where the music actually makes it funny. And the violence is so horrific, there's something lighthearted that can make you laugh. And with The Entertainer, I did laugh at some of the slapstick. But this was relentless, this film. There was nothing funny about it, which made it sad.
I remind you about two friends of mine. One was married, one was single. A married guy tells a single guy, "Oh, what's the matter with you? What's the matter with you? Look at me, and look at you, and look at me, and look at you." Now, let me get out. When I come home at night, my wife's at the door with a tall drink in her hand. And she gives me a nice hot bed. Then she gives me a nice rub down. Then she makes passionate love to me. And then she makes me a nice dinner. What more could you ask for? You ought to try that. The other friend says, "Hey, that sounds great. When does your wife get home?" I know I'm no Olivier, but if he fought Sugar Ray, he would say that the thing ain't the ring, it's the play. So give me a stage where this bull here can rage. And though I can fight, I'd much rather hear myself recite.
I'm always analysing, why is that funny? How did he get to that point where it's funny? I mean, I have to say, the other night when I was watching Jack Nicholson in Something's Gotta Give, I mean, I laughed all the way through that. I don't associate him with funny films or being funny, but I laughed all the way through that. I thought he was hilarious in that.
I remember watching As Good As It Gets for the first time, and there's the moment when his neighbor tries to drop the dog off with him, and there's the whole thing about, you know, the why does the dog like him? Why doesn't it like the neighbor? And I thought, what's really clever about this is that this character is completely unsympathetic, and yet he's really funny. And I thought that was what was really smart about that, was the character is horrible and he's all the things that his neighbor isn't, and yet the dog seems to love him.
And you think, you know what, if the dog likes him, he must be all right. there must be something all right about him.
That's right. Are you an animal person? Do you have pets?
No, not really. No.
Because life on the road, touring all the time.
Yeah, I mean, you've really got to keep those animals alive when you have them.
You do, yes. That's a kind of minimum requirement. I would say keeping them alive, that's the lowest of the bars.
I mean, I would love to have a little puppy, but you've got to feed it and you've got to take it out for walks and stuff. And I've thought about it. It's gone through my mind in the past where I've thought, you know, if I just go, you know, to Manchester for a couple of days, will he be all right? No, I don't want to come back and find an animal dead in my house.
No, I think you're making an absolutely correct and informed decision. I think not coming home to find an animal dead in your house is definitely a tick that box. I don't want to do that thing. So look. Yeah. So what is going to happen now? I mean, obviously, you said the tour obviously had to be stopped because of COVID. Do you have plans for the coming months? How does it look for stand-up? Because this must be a very difficult time for comedians.
I mean, I spent a year writing this show, which was called Coconut, and it was, you know, there was a lot of stuff about Brexit in it, and there was stuff about reality TV, how I felt that reality TV was partly a cause for Brexit in the way that people voted for stuff mindlessly. And now I read through the show. I was reading through the show the other night and I thought, this is all irrelevant. Nobody cares. Unless I can relate all of this to coronavirus, what else, what is there to say, really? I mean, who's going to care about this? Well, it's very much about the now. And I have to tailor this show and rewrite this show for the moment, because so much has happened now that my show seems out of date, and I only finished writing it a couple of months ago.
But, you know, I mean, to be honest with you, when we come out the other end of this, I don't think I want to talk about coronavirus. I kind of think we've all been talking about nothing else. I'd love to see the show you wrote about Brexit and reality TV, I mean, frankly.
I will relate it to what's happened now. But also, I found that during this pandemic, the public have been really funny. I have never laughed so much as I have done in this pandemic. People sending these funny videos and memes around. I've had so many every day. And they're not comedians, they're ordinary people.
Yeah.
And I thought, God, the British public, they are hilarious.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, that amazing stand-up act that Dominic Cummings did, when he said with a totally straight face that he was just testing his eyesight by driving 50
miles. Testing his eyesight?
The totally straight way that he delivered that, you know, is almost like, it's almost like you think, guy, he's not taking the piss.
He really didn't have to drive halfway up the M1 to test his eyesight,
But it was great. There was an announcement that they've reopened car showrooms, and apparently you can test the cars, you know, on your own, which is great. It means that Dominic Cummings can test his eyes and his car at the same time, which is, it's a win-win situation.
The Dominic Cummings eye tests that have come out since Barnard Castle, from really big letters to really small letters. This kind of thing is so funny. And just everything about it, you know, staying alert. I mean, what does that mean? I've been so alert, I haven't been able to sleep for 3 nights. I mean, well, how do you stay alert? Why is everyone just going around being alert? I mean, it was just joke after joke, really.
No, this stay alert just sounds like they're telling you to take speed. You know, get into that kind of, that sort of slightly paranoid, like,
thing. Stay alert. I mean, surprised anybody was sleeping. What does that mean, stay alert? I mean, it was so funny. Well, the whole of it.
So it sounds like you've been productive. You know, you've been writing, you've been watching films, you've been thinking about the future. So it actually sounds like you had a fairly productive lockdown.
I think, you know, comedians, you have to be doing something that you think is you're going to be able to use when you come out of here. I got worried a few weeks ago when I thought the lockdown was going to end and I hadn't achieved that much. So I suddenly started writing, watching films, making videos, because I didn't want to feel like I'd wasted 10 weeks of my life. I mean,
I interviewed Jason Isaacs recently, and I asked him, you know, how has it been? And he said, well, you know, I finished writing this screenplay and the novel, and he said, and I've always wanted to learn Arabic, and so, you know, I've been learning Arabic. And I said, really? He went, no, I haven't done anything at all. You know, but he said everyone feels like they need to start by saying, well, obviously I've made a model of Buckingham Palace out of matchsticks. No.
All people have been doing has been cooking. And they've been, oh my God, this has been the big hit of the whole virus. Everybody's been cooking and everybody has been showing everybody else what they've been cooking, filming it, putting it on social media. And you know what? Most of it looks awful. I mean, some of it is awful. I saw Nigella tweeting going, God, that looks awful. And I just thought, but you know what? It's a sense of achievement. Oh, look, I baked a cake today. No, it doesn't matter how it looks or how awful it tastes. This is what I've done today. Yeah, well, let me post that on social media.
My sense of achievement has been when I put out the glass, you know, on the cheese. Look how many bottles of white wine we've got through. Look, that's really that. We had to put the hours in to get through that.
My greatest achievement has been my recycling. Putting the correct cartons in the correct boxes. Usually I just chuck it all into one box, but during this pandemic, I've actually put the glass and the cardboard and the plastic in their correct boxes. And I'm really proud of that.
Well, you know, it just goes to show it's never too late to learn a new skill. Listen, thank you so much for coming on the show. I hope that when we have when we're allowed back into the real world, we can invite you back to come on in person rather than virtually. And when you do come, I'd like you to bring some of that wallpaper with you, because it's going to live with me for a long time.
It's going to live with me as well.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Lovely having you on the show. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks. Bye.
My thanks to Shazia Mirza and Simon Pegg. If you've enjoyed listening to those interviews, then remember to go to the BFI channel on YouTube and search MK3D. Thanks ever so much for listening. If you like the podcast, remember to subscribe, tell your friends. Why not visit our Patreon page, where there's loads and loads of extras, including exclusive video content. See you next week. Thanks for listening. Stay safe. Keep watching the skies.